This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 28th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 312 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On the show today, we'll be talking about quality of life, some quality art, and how the two can enhance one another with the founder of London's Listen Gallery, Nicholas Logsdale.
Later on, we'll also be horsing around with the stars of the stage. Andrew and I will be getting a masterclass in puppetry and learning how to embrace one's inner spirit animal with a few of the talented naysayers behind Warhorse. Marcus Shabbing, James Alexander Taylor, and Gary Mitchinson will be here later.
And we'll hear from author, academic, and lover of all things indigo, Jenny Balfour Paul, about a Victorian adventure whose global travels helped inspire her own worldview.
That's all to come. Plus, Tom Edwards will be here with us to forecast next week's top stories in the news. Look ahead and enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we are, Andrew. We've recovered from our quality of life party hangovers. How is it for you? Did you exit through the back door talking to your bag? Or was it an early night? My memory of these occasions always gets a bit misty after a certain period.
You are reminding people of a notorious occasion in the very early years of Monocle, which is now, I must say, a long time ago, where such an enjoyable drinks session that I was found chatting to my bag on the way home saying, we can make it.
We can make it. It's going to be fine. well, we have it on good authority that this happened, didn't we?
Yes. Well, unfortunately, I was with our editor-in-chief's mother at the time. I said goodbye to her, jumped out of a cab.
She told on you.
And bounced my way home. So it wasn't the healthiest. No, but that was very good. Also, I'm very pleased to say that The Escapist, our new magazine for the summer, has lived
up to its name.
It's escaped. It's gone to the printers. It's going to be out in a couple of weeks' time. And you're still bearing the rather good tan from Thailand, where you've been reporting for it as well.
Yeah, that was a good one. I love that. That was a nice magazine to put together. I just think a few of the pictures that were taken on my holiday, I mean, my assignment, could have made it onto the front cover. But hey, let's not bring the upstairs news from the office floor downstairs here to the radio, Andrew.
No.
We don't want to do that, do we?
Instead,
we don't want to talk shop.
Let's talk about global news with the one and only Tom Edwards.
Who's got a waggy tail?
Who's got a winning grin?
Who can sniff out the spookiest news?
Who knows when to bark and bite?
Who's got the nicest coat?
Who can round up some global tales?
Who can scent a breaking story?
And who likes his tummy tickled?
Oh yes, it's that lovable news hound.
It's Tom Edwards.
Come home, Daddy.
Ah, there he is. It's that time again.
I would make a new one for you, but I'm still unconvinced that it can be surpassed.
I think we should get one with some, because that's got a sort of Disney quality to it.
Mm. Yeah.
We get some with some talking luggage in it.
Talking
luggage? What are you talking about?
For Andrew.
Talking to your bag.
After he's had a couple of drinks.
That was the one problem. The bag didn't talk back. It wouldn't give me any guidance along that road.
I'd like to make that bag. I buy him a drink.
It's seen a few things.
Yeah, the porter tote remained dumb and still does to this day.
Okay, let's move on from my indiscretions.
I don't know. I feel like the tables turned once. Took it away from my barking mad intro.
This table is well and truly bolted down.
Okay,
where should we begin?
Well, I thought we'd start. This is rather interesting. Do you know what's happening on Tuesday? Basically, the Earth is slowing down. I feel this is quite a big worry, but apparently it's nothing, you know, of undue concern.
But it's only happening on Thursday.
Tuesday.
No, it's Tuesday.
Or Tuesday, rather.
So what happens is, dials just before midnight,
yeah.
If you have like one of those sexy atomic clocks, you know, we have these kind of things here at Midori House, it will read 11:59:59, then 11:59:60, and then 12:00:00.
What?
It's
is
a
that
leap,
possible?
It's a leap second.
A leap second.
They're adding it in. To balance out the slowing rotation of the globe. And they do this from time to time, apparently.
So the Earth generally over history is slowing down?
It's just slowing down just a fraction.
But, and I presume it's not exactly precise, is it, all that spinning stuff?
Well, they haven't. Well, I, they go to
freelance scientist as Andrew Tuck said
as
earlier.
As a scientist, no. But what I like, what I love about this though, if you go to Paris, in the city, you'll find the International Earth Rotation Service. Not making this up. It's a genuine body. They advise on these things,
and they'll
be
keep
like,
it going.
We need a leap second. You know, end of 20. Well, you know, middle of 2015. Need to add one in. Just to balance things up.
So, do you think they're on the phone? Is that Rolex? Just got some news here. You got to change.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. Slowing down. Anyway, that happens on Tuesday, so you can watch out for that if you've got one of those atomic clocks.
I'm going to stay up just to see it.
We've got an extra second. What could you do in that time? All sorts of things.
Don't know. Next.
End of the week, 4th of July.
By the way, I love that. I love that. I love Andrew's really unsubtle vision for the sky at night.
I sense Andrew was unmoved by that. End of next week.
The Earth moved for me.
4th of... It's nice. End of next week, 4th
Rather
of July.
Rather slowly these days, it seems, though.
Well, extra second. That's what you could do with your extra second. 4th
Don't
of July.
Don't need that much time.
Please. This is a serious piece of news journalism. All sorts of things happen on the 4th of July around the world. A few things in the US, of course. My site's going to be trained on France, though. The Tour de France gets underway. It's my favourite sporting event of the year, in fact. And, you know, it's starting in Utrecht. Now, this is a place whose cycling pedigree is well known to us at Monocle.
Indeed.
Yes. He's kind of young. Tom Reynolds, who works upstairs, he went to cover the Utrecht cyclers and... He didn't get on the bicycle.
Did he not do it?
No, he sat in the car with the photographer following them. Right. And then you'll see a picture of him at the end of the story drinking a beer. But that was... He was a bit worn out by the experience. But
that's not immersive. That's not immersive journalism. Anyway, no, all his new friends from that Utrecht cycling club, imagine how excited they're going to be.
I know.
Extraordinarily
excited.
This whole caravan of excitement.
Have they noticed, though, it's not in France?
But they do this, though, Andrew.
That was a joke. That was a cycling joke.
Sorry.
Pedants peddling cycling joke.
That's good. And on the other side of the pond, 4th of July, all sorts of crazy things happen in the US. Usually various forms of gross overconsumption. I think I've maybe mentioned this before, but they have a sort of competitive eating contest at Coney Island, which is quite well known. That happens every year on the 4th of July. They've been doing it since for 99 years they've been doing it.
One thing in particular you eat, or you could eat anything?
No, it's competitive hot dog eating, Andrew.
Ooh.
And there's a technique for that, isn't it? I mean, that's the sort of it's the sort of event at which your gag reflex presumably is tested.
Well, that's it, and it tests the likes of Joey Chestnut from San Jose in California.
Oh, yeah.
He won again last year. He took the mustard belt and the grand prize. Not making this up. Seventh straight win. Wow. Do you know how many he ate? 61 hot dogs and buns.
Oh, in how long?
61. I don't have the specific thing. Yeah, it's a few minutes. I think it's under 10 minutes.
That's horrid.
And you just have to feed them in.
Yeah.
So it's not really that enjoyable. Where does it go?
And what happens to you afterwards?
Oh, God, I don't know. I think you'd be
rather good in that competition.
I'd give it a bash. Should I go along next year, maybe? I don't know.
For me, you have your lunch too far away from your mouth. In order to be quick, you need to really...
Oh, that's it, yeah. My competitive elbow action food. Exactly. But that's not the end of it. In Michigan, they have the Cherry Pit Spitting Championship.
Very nice.
Spit three.
What an edifying spectacle that sounds.
As far as you can. The furthest one wins a prize. That's it. Simple as you like.
So you chew the cherries.
But just by measure, by way of comparison, here in Europe, slightly more sedate. There's an easier pace to things. If you're in the Rioja region in Spain, now and Tuesday, in point of fact, it's the Battle of Wine. I'm ready.
Battle of Wine? What does that mean?
So it's the Feast of San Pedro, and there's a couple of towns in Rioja, and they had a traditional land dispute. Mm. And then it came to be sort of marked by this traditional ceremony. So they have church services, a big fiesta. But they have this wine battle. Basically, they fight with wine.
So they
in kind of like water pistols. Yeah, wow. Water pistols. 40,000 litres of wine. And they duke it out in the streets of these little towns. Imagine that.
That sounds like the Monocle Quality of Life party.
I mean, a lot of people talking to their bags
imagine the dry cleaning bill. I don't know. Heaven knows what happens. But then they just have all-night revelry in the style of our Spanish friends.
Sounds great, doesn't it?
That's good fun.
That's the one for me. I like that. I think I would like that more than eating 61 hot dogs. Well, that's a good stomach liner.
You'd probably feel
better. Maybe get the flight over
a coat
from
of primer,
New York.
And then head up.
From New Jersey, wherever it was, too. Yeah, that'd be good. Thinking ahead.
And then something a little more far-flung and flighty. And this just intrigues me. On Wednesday, Pyongyang, they're opening their new airport terminal. This has been knocking around the story a little bit, but it's for international flights, of which there basically aren't many. So I don't really know what the point of this is, but I'd be intrigued to see what it looks like.
No, it's basically a terminal specially designed to house Dennis Rodman and only Dennis Rodman.
Exactly. but, you know, I like the idea.
Yeah.
No, that'd be a good story.
Trying to sort of open things up a little. But and the old airport will just be for internal flights, of which there aren't many of those either.
I was going to say.
I don't think it's not a big...
I thought they just put you in a catapult and shot you up to the... Yeah.
Many years ago, when I worked at the Independent, I sent our very own Steve Bloomfield to Pyongyang.
Oh, that's right.
Damn well let him out again.
As hard as you try, Andrew. There must be somewhere. Is there somewhere even more forbidden that you could?
I might phone them again, see if they can go to the international terminal.
Anyway, that's happening on Wednesday for aviation and airport enthusiasts to keep an eye on.
Tom, thank you. Oh, all that. Tom, thank you very much for a rather wonderful news look ahead.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
For London.
Para Zurich.
A Barcelona.
Esta é Monocle 24.
Wir loset Monocle Theatertask.
Broadcasting around the world.
Around the clock.
This is Monocle 24.
As you may have gathered, Monocle magazine is celebrating its annual Quality of Life issue this month, and we enjoyed many of our friends and neighbours coming to Midori House on Thursday for a party to help launch the issue and also enjoy a few of the good things that life has to offer.
One of those friends is Nicholas Logsdale, founder of Listen Gallery, the London institution that's been testing the boundaries of art's role in the world since 1967. Whether it's the monumental structures of Anish Kapoor, the regime-challenging pieces of Ai Weiwei, or the more practical thoughts of contemporary artists such as Ryan Gander, who wants to educate as many people as he can, Listen Gallery's artists create that rare phenomenon, art that looks past the gallery and into people's everyday lives. And Nicholas is back at Midori House today to tell us more about it. Nicholas, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
And we're kind of neighbours as well at Midori House.
Well, yes. I mean, neighbours should be seeing each other more often. I think it was about a year ago.
Yes, indeed. Exactly.
So this is something we can talk about. And we
talked about that before, I think, in the lobby when we were plotting a party, I think, actually, about the idea of a gallery's role in a neighbourhood. You've been on Bell Street, just off the Edgware Road, between that and Marylebone Station since 1967. So many galleries move or they add other parts and parcels and moving pieces to their places, whereas you've stayed put and you're part of that community. Is that something very definite that you wanted to do and have continued to do?
I think in life there are the things that make decisions for you, and there are the very strategic and conscious or unconscious strategic, unconscious, whatever decisions you make. And I was far too young to be even thinking in those terms. I came to London about a year and a half before, and I was studying, coming up from Buckinghamshire, where I was actually living in a tree, believe it or not. I feel both proud and embarrassed because I built it with my own hands from the age of 13 to 19.
We should not be surprised that Listen started as a sculpture gallery.
So Bell Street was an accident, and Marylebone Station was my mainline station back home. I wandered around one early morning after a party, missed the last train home. It was sort of summertime like this, and it was just getting light. And wouldn't that be a good idea to find somewhere to live near to the train station to go home? And that's really why the gallery is there. There's no other reason.
So it's serendipity that took you to Bell Street all those years ago.
But it served us very well.
Yeah.
What I liked about it was that it was a real local neighbourhood. Also that it was extremely central. And also that it was undiscovered, so to speak. And it had a wonderful street market. And in those days, as in many parts of London, that your local butcher and veg shop, and it still has some remnants of those days with some great secondhand bookstores. You know, it still has a local feeling about it.
But Nicholas, when you as an outsider in this world, you often read or you see this debate about, you know, oh, we had to move our gallery because actually overseas buyers now won't go beyond, you know, Mayfair, or we had to move because, you know, the contemporary heart of the city has shifted east. But for you, did you feel that over all these years you could just be calm and let people have those debates and it would come back to you?
I think that you have to be doing something that people find interesting. If it's interesting enough, people will come to you. I mean, there is many a gallery in the West End, and I go round the galleries on a Saturday morning about once every 6 weeks or so, and you can walk into one empty or almost empty Mayfair gallery after another. You can do a dozen of them in about 3 or 4 hours, and I will always return back to Bell Street, and lo and behold, the gallery is full of people. So why would one want to join that club of empty galleries waiting for somebody with the biggest gold Rolex you've ever seen in your life to walk in through the door? It doesn't happen that way. I think that it's not about the snobbery of a Mayfair street or a Mayfair address. It's about the convenience of getting there, but it's above all about the quality of what you do and the authenticity of what you do. And also, I believe that being where we are keeps us on our toes, because we have to deliver really great exhibitions consistently.
And what about your, because you're in two, you're also, we should say to our listeners that haven't visited your gallery, it's in two halves, which might piss some people off, but it's actually a fantastic thing because it always gives you the opportunity to do at least two things, doesn't it?
Well, we did that for a number of reasons. Yeah. A, we ran out of space, which means you're growing, and we are continuing to grow. We opened 3, 4, 5 years ago in Milan. We have office in Singapore. We have office in New York. And we're building a new gallery, which should be open next year. And we will probably have another space in New York as well. So I think things don't stand still. If they stand still, they slowly sink.
Do people like the spaces? Presumably artists love the spaces that you're offering them to work in. When people do site-specific stuff, as many of your artists do, are they reacting to the spaces that you've made for them by hook and by crook?
I think that spaces, there's something very interesting about the Tony Fretton building, which is the first of the two that's still in the street, because we didn't start in either of those two buildings. We started at number 68, which is now called International Trading Company or something. So this is our dark secret. This is our real business.
International trade. I know. What do they sell? Concrete boots.
I don't know. It looks a bit shady to me. The Fretton building is kind of interesting because we built that in 1990. In the heart of the Great Recession of that era. And it was the best, smartest thing we could possibly do. The art world needed a bit of a lift. The building was beautiful. And as a matter of fact, it was the first new building that had been built in over 100 years for the housing of contemporary art. It was also the largest gallery space in London at that time, which is quite astonishing. Now you look at it and you think, this is such a perfect building, but there's something not quite right for now, which is the scale.
You think it's too small?
I don't think it's too small. I think it's great.
It's small considering everything
else. But it is small in scale compared to the extraordinary renditions of space by our galleries, which I think gives artists a bit too much of a challenge.
I was going to say, I wonder if it's nice to be challenged by the space, by the confines of it, sometimes as much
as the artist. We got the space down the road on the other side, which is a larger scale of space, and then that was the biggest space in London. And then Gagosian opened. And that's...
Oh, Larry.
I remember him coming round because somebody said, this is the biggest space there is. And I could just sort of, I kind of had a sense of what was going on in his mind. Yeah. He had to do something bigger, which is fine.
Can I ask you about the artists? Can you be completely in control of your artists? Would you ever want to be?
Well, I think if you were in control of your artist totally, that would be a contradiction of the purpose of making art and working with them.
But it's one thing to, because a lot of fantastic careers have started at your gallery, but they've stayed there. And that's something that happens less and less these days, isn't it? People staying at the mothership.
But that's also to do with what your interaction is, what you're providing, and the spirit in which you are doing what you're doing. And I started as an artist, so I think I get it with artists. I understand that they're bit complicated. Well, I'm a bit complicated too, so you put that together and you can make life maybe less complicated by joining in partnership in terms of achieving the objectives of the artist and the artist supporting the objectives of what you're trying to achieve for them and for the organization, because a gallery has the advantage of being a house of many artists and the art world a world of many mansions, like the Tate Gallery or the Whitechapel or all the other galleries.
And is it the personal relationships that keep that stitched together, that keep your relationship and your gallery directors that listen in tune with the artists? Because, you know, it's a demanding relationship, isn't it? A lot, some of the time, not all of the time, but is it all personal?
No, I think it's above all about relationship and trust and paying attention. And we can't pay attention to everything all the time, of course not. But it's paying attention when there's that sense that you'll need it. It needs you or you need it. And I seem to have a good instinct for that. You know, I have very, very dear friends amongst artists, collectors, writers. I cannot see them for a year or two. And it's like yesterday when you see them and you pick up where you left off. There's something very special about that. That's not unique to the art world, but the art world is one of those worlds where you can do that almost in every civilized and a few uncivilized countries in the world.
And Nicholas, that a slightly different tangent, but you know, one of the things you know that working with Rob, you see is the demand on a journalist, which isn't the biggest demand out there, on just attending fairs these days and being on this kind of global tour all the time. For a gallery such as yours, is that, it's the lifeblood, but is that the demand of all these additional fairs that are popping up and as smaller ones trying to increase their muscle? How do you see that world of the fair?
It's a way of popularizing or educating, maybe. Educating people who've got, many of whom have just find it very convenient to see what 100 or 200 galleries are doing. Now you can walk through an art fair and really be feeling rather insecure and even almost blind if you have no knowledge. On the other hand, people are deterred from doing that, thinking they have no knowledge. And when you introduce them to it, or the same applies to coming to the gallery, they're insecure about what they feel they don't know, only to discover that they know half of it anyway, because they live in the world, just as artists live in the world, and we all live in the same world. So these insecurities are really coming from a sense that it's an elite and expensive territory, which it's not. Listen, gallery is one of the cheapest places in London to go. It doesn't cost you anything. It's open every day.
Yeah.
It's free, just as the museums are free. Art is actually incredibly accessible. And today, I think that, especially in this country, because of the free admission to museums, you can educate yourself very easily, up to a point anyway. It's all there. The books are in the bookshops. The writing is there. The artist's thinking is there. You have to be extremely lazy not to pick some of it up if you have the interest, even the little sparkle of interest. And you do or you don't have those experiences. If you're lucky enough to have that sort of first-order epiphany when you walk into a museum or a gallery and you see something amazing that is taking you out of yourself and out of your own mental space into a kind of epiphany, if you like. That's what I look for. When even with artists I've worked with, Anish Kapoor, I've worked with more than 30 years, I still look forward occasionally to that epiphany, maybe more than occasionally, visiting the studio, and there is something astonishing there that is unexpected. And that builds your relationship as well. As Anish will always say, I've probably seen every single work he's ever made. I think that's, he's being very generous, but I have seen most of what he's made. And that applies to many of the artists we work with, not all, not the ones who live abroad, who can't be everywhere all the time, but the artists who are important to us and close to us are obviously the ones more in your patch because they're local. Having said that, the local artists must be international to be meaningful in the culture we live in today.
Well, let's steer our listeners in the direction then of Charisa Hushieri and Sergio Camargo Mamore at both sides of Bell Street's Listen Gallery. Nicholas Logsdale. Yeah.
Yeah.
You were going to correct me on my pronunciation.
I was going to say, everybody gets it wrong with Charisse.
I know, Charisse.
It's Charisse Hushieri.
We had Austin in here the other day and he corrected me three times.
Yes.
And then I haven't learned much.
It drove her so crazy in the early days of her career. She said, what do I do? Nobody gets my name right. I said, well, you know, if you become well-known enough, everybody will. And you're not the only one with a complicated name.
Nicola Logsdale.
Yes.
Thank you very much for joining us. Time for some new music. Now we'll be discussing all things Indigo a little later, but now from his recent album In Colour, this is London's very own Jamie XX with Loud Places. I've been to loud places.
trust someone to be quiet with, who will take me home.
That was Jamie XX with Loud Places. We'll be talking to the cast of Warhorse after this.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse, and eminently digestible world of food, drink, and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs, and trade secrets with our Asia editor at large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month, a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
Now on the Monocle Weekly, time for something a little different. We're often graced with the presence of notable faces from the worlds of arts and culture on this programme, but today we're meeting a trio who entertain audiences every night in one of London's most successful stage shows, Warhorse. And yet, you might never have seen their faces at all.
That's because Marcus Schabbing, James Alexander Taylor and Gary Mitchinson play the horse itself, Joey, the enigmatic life-size puppet that gallops, canters and neighs its way through the box office breaking play set in the First World War and based on the best-selling book by Michael Morpurgo. The play also inspired a Steven Spielberg film effort too. So how do you bring Joey to life? We have the three chaps around the table to find out. And also, by the way, welcome to the show.
Hello.
And first of all, interestingly, and this is really to help Andrew and I out, we've got Marcus, James and Gary sitting in that order in an anti-clockwise way around our desk. And this is head, heart and arse. Hind, yes. Hind. I mean, sorry, so very sorry. So this is it. Do you? And I mean, the million-dollar question presumably is: do you kind of? Are you? Is it impossible to separate you in real life? Do you wander around? Do you become? Do you know? Can you finish each other's sentences? Can you? Do you know each other's body language? Do you know when the heart is sad and the head is too happy, and the hind is a little bit behind?
Yeah.
Now we have three, we've also got three mics on, so it's going to be difficult. But let's take it in reverse order. Let's ask the hind first. Gary.
So in the horse, as we call it, we're not allowed to talk. So we read each other's body language, basically. JT, as he's fondly known. I can read what he wants in the horse from pressure or through certain breaths that he does, equally with Marcus as well, because I can see from the back of the horse where the head is in alignment. So we get to be able to read each other quite scarily well without even speaking, basically.
So it's not a good place inside that horse, you know, when the lights go up every night. It's not the greatest environment in which to have a hangover, one of you, right?
I wouldn't know.
James, can I ask you, it's obviously an incredibly physical job. Do you come through this through being an actor, a dancer? What was your route into the horse, as
I
it were?
The beauty of the show, the centre of it being puppets, and in this case, a three-person puppet, you can come from any background, musical theatre, acting, acrobatics, because it's a very specific way of working within puppetry. And you have a very specific emotional and technical role that you're responsible for. You learn from scratch. You learn a completely new way of approaching. It's like approaching a character in a play.
But when they're casting, are they looking for people who have strength or mobility or grace of movement? What the kind of tests are they looking for?
All those physical attributes, they will aid you, but because it's a very specific muscular work, you have to retrain your body and it becomes a muscle memory. So when you first start learning, your body is doing really unnatural things that it's never done before. So you have a terrible shock when you get into the horse, especially when you have a rider put on for the first time. It's like you're stuck in mud. You can't move at all. But eventually you gain this muscle memory and it just becomes an extension of you.
And Marcus, you're the head of the horse. Yes. You've got the one of the kind of, it's well known for being a very emotional play. It kind of drags your heart through the fields of the First World War. You've got the ears there, which are a kind of key emotional indicator for this beast. But at the same time, none of you can take any of all of the credits. So it's quite an unactorly thing where you want to be centre stage, yeah. But actually you all have to work very well together. Do you ever swap? Have you ever swapped it? Or do you know your own role very well?
I have never swapped. I've only been ahead. There have been puppeteers that have started
Sounds
out.
Sounds like he doesn't want to either, gents.
No, I would actually be interested in being a heart. I could never be in the hind.
Sorry.
No, but I feel like...
sitting very far away from each other. Yeah.
No, but I feel like also character-wise, hinds tend to be really patient and calm, which I need to move. So it's really good that I'm free outside next to the horse. I couldn't stand being in the hind, I think. And as a heart, you need to be calm as well, but you get to move a bit more, I feel.
Yeah, every single part is completely different, technically and physically. And you go through, you know, Marcus, for example, holds a head that weighs about 5 kilos up in the air for about 2.5 hours.
With one arm.
on one arm.
Do you have to swap arms?
I mean, you're not allowed to, because otherwise that would... distract and people would actually start watching me.
So you could be found in the gym just sort of
just whipping the water.
Just whipping.
You just switch sides, but you never switch the arm.
Right.
So you switch around, but
people again, it's fine. The listeners will insert their own joke.
And Gary, for you, you know, the interesting thing, I guess, for, you know, actors always say that, you know, they can, you know, performance is dependent on who's in the audience and they feed off the reaction and they see what people are, you know, are doing. But you're kind of blinded in many senses. How do you feed off the... Are you, again, almost like the horse's ears, are you attentive to, you know, the audience feedback, whether people are making the right noises in the crowd? Are you listening out to know how well that evening is going?
Yes and no. I mean, there's certain points in the play, like after the transformation, as we call it, where baby Joey breaks through into big Joey, which is what we play. And sometimes you get a round of applause, other times you don't. And when you don't, it's a bit like, But that's another... But again...
It's never our fault.
Yeah, it's never our fault. It's music and lighting. But we're always communicating, but without speaking. So the whole listening thing is part of that communication, because we have to listen to breath or whatever Marcus is doing on the head, but, and things like that. Yeah. So when you hear the audience, if they're quiet, then you're always a little bit like, what's happened?
It's difficult not to play on that as well.
Yeah, of course it is.
You are so focused for 2.5 hours without speaking and there for each other 2.5 hours. So when you are getting reactions that you're not used to that are, you know, are positive from an audience, it's very hard to just stay hoarse, as we call it, you know, not to react to something that you as a human react to. You know, there's the simplistic thoughts that horses have, and they are very simple.
Like, dislike, that's basically
exactly,
it, really.
Exactly. So to react accordingly to how a horse would do is... It's probably the most challenging thing all the way through the show.
I found in the beginning it's really hard. You need to forget to understand language. So you tend to react to an actor's line, but obviously you don't understand what they're saying. So after a while, once you've taught yourself to ignore what they're saying, basically, I sometimes find if people drop lines, I'm not even aware of it, because I'm trying only to listen to the tone of the scene. So if the emotion boils up, I'm going to react as an animal to that, and not to whatever anyone is saying.
And Marcus, once you'd been cast, how long is the training before you make your first appearance on stage? And do they still have to go back to the beginning with everybody who joins the cast and get them to kind of, you know, understand how a horse moves to bring you into that equine world?
So the puppeteers start 2 weeks prior to all the rest of the cast. So we have 2 weeks of intense puppetry, and we get introduced to puppetry. So we literally started off playing with paper men and sticks like little kids, to just manipulate a stick and bring it to life. And if our puppetry director used to say, if you can do that, then the puppet is going to be really easy, because the puppet is really, it does half the job for you, because it's a really well-built puppet and you can already do that with a little stick. So that once you get into horse, obviously you need to learn the mechanics of that. And then we studied horse behavior, studied what they like, what they don't like, how they communicate. And then once the cast joins you, obviously they have to learn that as well. And then on top of that, they have to learn how to treat the puppet, because obviously it's not a real horse. So there's certain...
no one has the sound there of hearts breaking all over the world.
So they need to learn to play along and not... Because for some reason, weight and pushing and everything gets magnified inside the puppet. So if someone leans against the horse, you can easily push JT and Gary over if you really go for it, because I don't know why, but it's really... Everything is magnified. Someone can easily pull the head out of my hand if they just pull on the reins. Everything needs to be mimed.
So it's very, fragile kind of balancing act that you're doing inside that horse. It's all kind of teetering on the brink of looking nothing like a horse, potentially.
Yeah. And it's when you first start, you are physically battling each other to try and get to grips with your own technical job. Mm. And when the penny drops, when it just falls together...
Suddenly it becomes easy.
An incredible feeling. There's something we do in the show... In the first charge, we do walking, trotting and galloping on the spot. So it's all to do with weight placement and how you're pushing away the floor to really show that horse's muscularity. So when you gallop on the spot, it's a very, very, with a rider, it's a very difficult thing to do physically. But when you get in sync with each other, it's fluid and it's a really magical thing when it happens.
I think another thing that you probably can talk about that I find really interesting is you never think about it when you see the horse, but the weight of the puppet and the rider is not on the horse's legs because they wear backpacks and the puppet's on their back. So they need to put all the weight, they need to mime the weight of the horse. So in the beginning when you start, for some reason it just, the horse doesn't come to life because it looks really wrong because... There's no weight going through the puppet's legs because it goes through the actor's legs or the puppeteer's legs. And once they put the weight into every step, suddenly it becomes real. It's really interesting.
So there's the physicality of it, and we love that. We've got the down low on that. What about the sound effects? We want to hear some neighing. That's everyone's rolling their eyes. You can't walk out of the studio until you've taught Andrew how to neigh.
Really?
Because I know that was something he wanted to learn before we started.
There's a whole range of noises that have snorts, nose blows, knickers, whinnies, screams.
Grumble. They're very grumbly characters, horses, aren't they?
Yeah, so...
Give us one.
So something like a nicker, for example.
What is a nicker?
It's a way of a horse saying, hey, how you doing? You know, I'm fine. You know, it's a very relaxed...
It's their way of communicating to each other. It's their way of talking.
Yeah, so it'd be something like, do you want to join in with me? Okay, so...
That's amazing! Yeah, well, I love that! Yeah. I think before the end, we will have a neigh. Well, we'll have a probably yeah, we'll a good old. We want a good old. I've just won the Grand National.
So a whinny, as we call it, is it's kind of a distress call, really, to say danger or I don't like that. So do you want me to start?
Yes, yeah. Let's have a.
So what I'm saying is, I'm going to start. We don't all join in together at the same time to get a full textured sound. I can start. Marcus Thick will then join, and then Gary will then join, and we can. Or finish it together, so you get a full. We might want to.
So this is
quite loud.
So this is a whinny. Okay. That's amazing! I love it. Isn't it good?
And can I just ask you? Yeah, you know, obviously, yeah. This show has been an extraordinary success, a global success. You've seen the show, you've been in it so long now. Do you understand the magic? You know, what brings people? Because what's striking is, you know, this has come out at a time when we've been celebrating what's happened in the First World War, when people are very focused on events. But it seems to unite, you know, from, you know, kids through to octogenarians, anybody of, you know, any race or creed coming to London, they kind of get it, even though it's a kind of British story at its heart. Do you understand what for you is the magic that comes out of it, do you think?
I spoke to Michael Wapogo last year about this, what he thinks is the key behind the success of this show and in a sense the story. And it's not just the backdrop being so poignant, especially now with the First World War, but just the basic idea of human and animal relationship. the idea of a boy talking and having a friendship, a loving friendship with a horse that is beautiful as a creature. They are beautiful to look at. And so within that, you have loss of Joey being sold to the war, and just that whole idea of loss, hope, and inevitably reunion as well. I think that everyone can relate to that, whether you're a five-year-old child or you're getting on a bit. Everyone can relate to that.
And even the extreme lengths that boy goes through to reunite with the horse. He joins the war just to find his horse. Mm. So yeah. I think that's what...
Well, and you said it's a very British story, but initially I think what makes it so universal is that you don't pick sides in this because you follow the horse and the horse doesn't pick sides. And it goes from the British front to the Germans and it's in France and then back again. And you follow the horse and... You don't even need to understand, because it is in three languages, you don't even need to understand the languages because you follow the horse and you everyone understands or doesn't understand, but you understand the horses in a way. And that's a universal language.
It is. It's beautifully physical. It's fantastic. And you're great at talking us through it as well. For such a physical thing that you do on stage every night, it's a difficult thing to talk about. It's fantastic.
Well, the detail we like to go into is... solely so it manifests on stage.
Yeah.
If it was to be, you know, anything less, we wouldn't be able to tell the story as fully as we want to.
Well, you're fantastic. Thank you very much, Marcus James and Gary, three men that shun butcher shops in Lyon, that want sugar lumps thrown on stage, not bunches of flowers. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The three of you for joining us.
Thank you.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Jenny Balfour-Paul is a writer, artist, traveller and lecturer, and her passion is a lifelong fascination with indigo. It's the plant which provides vivid blue and purple shades for use in any number of industries and the globe's only natural blue dye, and it makes our world just that little bit more colourful.
And Jenny is here today to talk about another topic that's held her attention over the years, the life of Victorian adventurer Thomas Matchell, whose appetite for exploring led him from Patagonia to Polynesia during the 19th century and saw him undertaking the job of becoming an indigo planter himself along the way. Jenny has compiled his story into a new book, Deeper Than Indigo, and she joins us now to tell us all about it. Jenny, welcome to the programme.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It is nice to be here, isn't it?
Yeah, great.
Well, also, only because at least Andrew and I are wearing something that can only led us to talk about indigo. Well,
so does everybody else when they wear their jeans.
We thought we were special. You're gonna have to try hard to come back from that one, Jenny. Reading around the subject, I read that you delivered a lecture once called A Blue Is to Die For. D-Y-E, nice pun.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether that was kind of the heart and soul of your and Thomas Matchell's journey, was that this is a dangerous and sort of epic quest to get this colour that's so ubiquitous these days.
Interesting you should ask that. I hadn't thought of it that way, because both things, the production of indigo itself was a quest. It was the world's, one of the huge commodities, because every single thing in the world that was dyed with blue was dyed with indigo. So it actually is a vast trade story, one of these big colonial stories like coffee or something. Also used for everything like navy blue-collar workers. And so there is all that story. And actually my own search for indigo has taken me to some difficult places.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually he's Machel, not Matchell. But I said Matchell for 2 years.
I was going to call him Michelle.
Michelle, but no, well, he's had lots of names. He's actually Thomas Machel. I call him Thomas, so that's all right.
That's easier, isn't it? He's Thomas to us. Yeah. We introduced him, now he's a friend.
But no. Actually at the time he was travelling. I mean, there were wars going on. It was the height of the empire. And the very one of those commodities that was subject to up and downs and lots of shipwrecks. And so actually, yes, quite colourful.
Jenny, we should explain how you came to meet him in the first place. It's thanks to somebody at the British Library. And why his writing pulled you in so quickly?
Well, actually, it wasn't somebody at the British Library. They're in the British Library. It was a librarian at Exeter University who knew about my passion for indigo because I'd spent about 20 years writing about it. I'd done a PhD on indigo in the Arab world, which was published as a book. I'd done a whole book on indigo. So he knew that indigo was my thing. He couldn't not by then. He saw an illustrated volume in the British Library, and it was rather quirky and funny, and it said indigo planters after tiffin, and he saw that word indigo and then looked at the label, five volumes of an indigo planter in the mid-19th century, and midshipman actually had a much bigger life than that, but that indigo word got him to phone me up. I wasn't interested. I'd done 20 years on indigo, so I didn't look at them till 1999. And then when I saw them, I was immediately attracted. They were 3,000 pages, and I didn't know which to look at first. He said, who would have thought indigo would have given me a chance to travel, have a fantastic career? That was extraordinary. And I looked at another page in another volume. I hope somebody will find these in a dusty library in the 20th century. And it was November 1999. And I saw the quirky illustrations, including that first one, which is actually drawn from the perspective of the humblest man in the room. So he's actually making fun of these two colonial planters who've got their feet on the table, they're smoking a pipe, and he is imagining, at 20 years old, what the man pulling the punker, what it looks like to that man, the humble man who's paid nothing, who nobody normally notices. So that empathy and that quirkiness and the colourfulness and his one-off, offbeat ideas really drew me in straight away, although I still didn't want to know about them.
And did Thomas have more of an empathy for the worker than for the plantation owner?
Absolutely astonishing. He's extremely critical. The indigo planters in Bengal have a very bad name, and he says quite rightly, and he will only work for one boss, who's a known philanthropist and has schools and hospitals on his estate. And he's always saying, if we go on treating the workers like this, there will be trouble. And there was, after the so-called Indian Mutiny in 1857, there was a Blue Mutiny in Bengal in 1859, when the workers rose up, killed their masters, sacked the estates, and that was when the indigo story left Bengal. He was right; he was way ahead of his time in his thinking. That's why I love him, really.
And in terms of the stuff itself, indigo itself, is there anything other than its financial value and its, you know, the way that it changed the world, it changed the world's economies, and it changed the way that trade routes works and all the rest of it. Is there something beguiling, mysterious, and crazy making about the stuff itself? Does it lead to a kind of a crazy type of particular hunger?
It's actually all. I'm not a chemist. I realised after a while it's to do with chemistry. There's no dye like it. Mm. All the others, you know, you can go and pick your leaves, boil them up, put your stuff in. Indigo is, you don't even see it. It's invisible in the plants. It's white. It's literally invisible. And you have to extract it using oxygen, it's absolutely bizarre. Before your eyes, this non-existent water turns blue because you're adding oxygen to the indigo white molecule. So that's extraordinary. You end up with this commodity, which is, it's a pigment at that stage, fantastic for trade and everything. And then to dye with it, you have to do the whole process in reverse. So you have to dissolve it, and the dye vat is not blue, and nothing works like that, no other dye. And when you pull it out of a dye vat, it's yellow and the oxygen hits it and it turns blue. And so all the myths and stories come from this magical chemistry.
So there's a bit of it must have been believed that it was alchemical rather
than
just chemical.
Yes, because it was a living thing. You were working with it. It had its own bacteria to make it work. And every other colour, which changes with time. Indigo cannot change, which is why its story remained for genes. Because there's loads of other synthetic dyes, but when they synthesise indigo, it's the same chemistry. So if you go into a denim factory and see the yarn, it's going into vats of yellow and coming out and turning blue. It's still the same magic. It's not made as synthetic indigo. And that blue can fade, you know, rubbing and everything on jeans. That's why we love them. So you're rubbing through layers of colour, but it's always, always blue. So it goes paler and paler to sky blue, but it cannot lose its blueness. And that's the only natural dye that ever behaved like that.
I love that answer. I loved your answer prefaced with the sentence, I'm no chemist, but... right?
And how did your personal obsession begin?
Oh, golly. We're living in the Middle East. and getting loving tech and being complete dilettante, because I was one of these people. I wanted to grab the world. I loved English, I loved art, I loved travel. And they all kind of came together, and living in the Middle East, I began to get really interested in the textiles and so on, and more than the other arts maybe. I learned how to do batik. I used to do these awful batiks with synthetic dyes, which I sold actually, amazingly. And then came back to UK and learned how to do indigo properly from my mentor, really, who taught me that it was special. Meanwhile, my late husband was working in the Arabic department at Exeter University, and he organised a conference on the two Yemens. And the two things converged because I put up an exhibition with stuff from Yemen, these shiny, beaten, you know, turbans like the Tuareg wear. Mm. I put up a shiny indigo dress, and my mentor said, Jenny, you need to get out there and record it because nobody's done it and it's dying out. So the whole thing kind of started from Yemen and getting more focused on indigo.
So so it is dying out. So your story and that of Thomas Machell. Machell. God.
Just call him Thomas.
I know.
Or Tom even.
Is one of a changing industry, a changing trade, presumably. It's inching back and people are using more synthetic dyes.
Well, the other way around, actually, because when I was started, and Susan, my mentor, said to me, Jenny, if you don't record it, there can't be future revivals. And I thought then, there won't be future revivals. We've all gone on to synthetic dyes. But I'll record it because I can see that point. And now, with everybody looking at sustainable textiles and fabrics, Levi Strauss last year produced their first range of jeans which were dyed in India, organic cotton and natural indigo. So if you use natural indigo from the fields, you can put it right back on the fields and fertilise the fields, and all the water's non-polluting. There's a real issue now about the pollution of synthetic dyes.
And perhaps almost finally, you could tell us what happens now with your relationship with him. The book is done. Do you feel that you have done his honour good, that you have unearthed this amazing story? What happens next?
Actually, somebody says the journey will change, as it always does. My whole life's been like that. You know, it's just all unfolded. I never looked to study indigo or to find these journals. And it is changing already. I haven't finished with the journals because his voyage through the Arab world with Muslims, pleading for understanding, is, I think, incredibly important today. He said, we must understand each other's religions. I'm getting serious here. Each other's religions, or we'll be having fights, and it'll be with the Wahhabis. I mean, he sort of foresees the problems we're having.
Well, there's an amazing bit in your book where he is travelling, I think, through what would be now contemporary Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And he's travelling with books on religion and faith, and he's meeting Muslims. Yeah, an amazing figure who's doing things that we don't even get to do today.
Fantastically open-minded. And, you know, he's a vicar's son, and yet saying we must understand each other. And we're not, are we? We're getting more entrenched, I think. So actually, I think I'd like to do more on that section of his life. Also, I'm about to do a first musical event because, you know, blues and indigo and harmony. Indigo is one of the colours of the rainbow. So actually, we're doing a musical event. Actually, my son's a professional jazz pianist, and we're doing our prototype in a couple of weeks to see whether readings from the book and the music will bring it all alive. So I think it's going in a more outward direction. When you write a book, it's very inward. He was in my head for 15 years. And now he's out there and everybody's heard his name, even if they can't pronounce it.
Sorry,
and it's
Jenny.
Like, you know, and people are interested in him. They're going to look at the diaries, yeah. You know. He's gone out. And I suppose I'll go out with him.
It's fantastic. She's got the blues. Jenny Balfour-Paul, author of Deeper Than Indigo. It really is. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
There we have it.
There we have it. Goodbye, Rob. Done.
Jenny Balfour-Paul, yes, I liked her. She's a very amusing character. Nicholas Logsdale, a legend of the London art world, the international art world, loved him very much as well. And the Warhorse Puppeteers, they cheered you up, didn't they, Andrew?
They were very nice people. I enjoyed their company.
Eyes to the front, Padre.
Eyes to the front, Padre. No, they were very nice indeed.
Heart, hind, and head.
All parts of that horse were very nice indeed. There we go.
And that's your review of that play.
Okay, I also
excellent.
Don't get me in trouble. No. I also like Nicholas's glasses.
I know, he's cool, isn't he?
He's got the good specs.
He has got good specs. Yes, he's always had that. That's been his sort of look. That he's had that look for quite a long time.
And I like the confidence when you become a legend. You know, you have your own pace at, you know, speaking. You listen. He's good.
Yeah, no, he's very cool. He's very good indeed. That's it. Well, we can hide from our hangovers no longer. We should embrace our Sundays, as should you out there. It is time for us simply to thank our team behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager was Chris Grimes. The Monocle Weekly will be back again at the same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.